Have you ever watched something die? Not slowly, not the way most things go, with a whimper and a long fade. I mean, watch something magnificent, something that took decades to build and perfect and believe in, just cease to exist in half a minute. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hanger on Radio Hanger. Pull up a chair, because today's story is one of the most famous moments in all of aviation. And 89 years ago today, it happened right in front of a crowd that could feel the heat on their faces. May 6, 1937, Lakehurst Naval Air Station, New Jersey, and a ship named Hindenburg was about to change everything. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com.
Now, to understand what happened that evening, you have to understand what the world lost, because we don't think about airships anymore. We think about them as a novelty, a footnote, some quaint relic from a black and white era. But in 1937, the rigid airship was the most luxurious way a human being could cross the Atlantic Ocean. Nothing else came close. Not ocean liners, not airplanes. Nothing. The Hindenburg was 803 feet long. Let that settle in. 803 feet. That is longer than three Boeing 747s parked nose to tail. She was the largest flying structure ever built, and she may hold that record forever. Her hull was draped in silver doped fabric stretched over duralumin rings, and inside that enormous frame sat 16 gas cells filled with 7 million cubic feet of hydrogen. And yes, we need to talk about the hydrogen, but not yet.
First, I want you to see what it was like to ride on her. Because the Hindenburg was not a balloon with seats. She was a flying hotel. The passenger quarters were enclosed entirely within the hull, not slung underneath in a gondola like the old wartime Zeppelins. There was a dining room with linen tablecloths and fresh-cut flowers, a lounge with a baby grand piano that weighed only 360 pounds because its frame was made of aluminum, promenade decks with angled windows where you could stand with a glass of Rhine wine and watch the Atlantic crawl by 1,000 feet below you at 80 miles an hour, sleeping cabins, a smoking room. Yes, they had a smoking room on a hydrogen airship. It was pressurized with a single electric lighter chained to the wall and an airlock door to keep any stray spark from reaching the gas cells. You could smoke a cigar above 7 million cubic feet of the most flammable gas on Earth. That was how confident they were. The crossing took about 2.5 days compared to 4 or 5 on the fastest ocean liner, and it was smooth, no waves, no seasickness, just that low thrumming hum of the Ford Daimler-Benz diesel engines pushing you west across the Atlantic. The Hindenburg had already made 10 round trips to North America the year before. In 1936, and 17 round trips to Brazil, she was a proven machine. The Zeppelin company had been flying rigid airships for decades without a single passenger fatality on a scheduled flight. Decades. The safety record was remarkable. So when she departed Frankfurt on May 3, 1937, for her first North American crossing of the season, there was no sense of dread. 61 crew members, 36 passengers, that was a light load. She could carry 72. The trip across was uneventful. Captain Max Pruss was in command. Ernst Lehmann, a legendary airship man and former commander of wartime Zeppelins, was aboard as an observer, almost a ceremonial figure at that point. They reached the American coast on the afternoon of May 6th. And that is where the weather turned. Thunderstorms over New Jersey. Nothing dramatic by our standards. Just a line of afternoon convective activity. But for an airship, a thunderstorm is not something you push through. Captain Pruss delayed the landing. He cruised south along the coast, circled, waited. The ground crew at Lakehurst, over 200 men plus Navy personnel, stood down and then stood back up again as the weather cleared. By 7 in the evening, the skies over Lakehurst had opened up enough. Commander Charles Rosendahl, the senior Navy airship officer on the ground, radioed the Hindenburg. Conditions acceptable for landing. Recommended approach from the southwest. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Hindenburg made her approach, but the winds shifted. Pruss was coming in a little fast, a little high. He ordered a sharp turn to line up with the mooring mast, and some investigators later believed that turn may have stressed the ship. At 7:21, the ground handling lines dropped from the bow. The ship was about 200 feet in the air, nose slightly high, the big swastika-marked tail fins hanging in the gray New Jersey sky. Newsreel cameras were rolling. A crowd of spectators stood on the field. Radio broadcaster Herb Morrison of station WLS in Chicago was recording a routine description of the landing. For a delayed broadcast, his words that night would become the most famous piece of audio in broadcasting history. At 7:25, something happened near the top of the ship, just forward of the upper tail fin, Witnesses on the ground saw a flicker, a small tongue of blue and yellow flame. Some saw the fabric ripple, as if something had shifted inside. It lasted maybe 2 or 3 seconds before the fire erupted. Then the hydrogen caught, and the Hindenburg died in 37 seconds. 37 seconds from the first visible flame to the skeleton of the airframe hitting the ground. The fire started at the stern, and it traveled forward through those gas cells at a speed that witnesses described as almost explosive. The tail dropped first as the rear cells collapsed, and the nose pointed up toward the sky as if the ship were trying to climb one last time. The flames were orange and red, and impossibly bright, and the burning fabric fell away in sheets, exposing the white-hot duralumin skeleton underneath.
Herb Morrison, who had been cheerfully describing the approach, began screaming into his microphone, "You know the words. Everyone knows the words. It's burst into flames. Get this, Charlie. Get this, Charlie. It's fire and it's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, the humanity." His voice cracked and broke. He wept on the air. That recording, which was not even broadcast live, became the signature sound of disaster in the 20th century. On the ground, the scene was chaos. The burning airframe settled onto the landing field, and the ground crew, many of them civilian volunteers, ran. Some ran toward the ship to help. Some ran for their lives. The passengers and crew inside had seconds to decide. Some jumped from the promenade windows before the ship hit the ground. Some rode the wreckage down and scrambled out through gaps in the flaming skeleton. The ship's fabric and hydrogen burned so fast that some people in the center of the structure survived simply because the fire had already passed over them by the time they reached the ground. Others were not so lucky. The diesel fuel from the engines burned hotter and slower than the hydrogen, and it was the fuel and the burning fabric and the superheated metal that killed most of those who died. 35 of the 97 people on board were killed, 13 passengers and 22 crew. One member of the ground crew also died, a young Navy linesman named Alan Hageman, who was caught beneath the falling structure. Ernst Lehmann walked out of the wreckage, his clothes burned off, his skin charred. He died the next day. Captain Pruss survived, badly burned, and spent over a year in the hospital. Now, the question that has burned almost as long as the ship, what caused the fire? The honest answer is that we still don't know for certain. The official investigations at the time, both American and German, could not conclusively determine the ignition source. The leading theories have shifted over the decades, and people get passionate about them. The most widely held theory for years was that a hydrogen leak developed in one of the rear gas cells, possibly from a bracing wire that snapped during that sharp final turn and punctured a gas cell. The leaked hydrogen mixed with air inside the hull, and some ignition source, probably a discharge of atmospheric static electricity, set it off. The ship had been flying through rain and electrically charged air all afternoon. Her outer cover was wet. The mooring lines, when they hit the ground, could have grounded the ship's frame while the outer skin remained at a different electrical potential. A spark between the two would have been invisible but deadly. There is another theory that gained traction in the late 1990s, championed by a retired NASA engineer named Addison Bain. He argued that the real culprit was the ship's outer fabric, which was coated with a mixture of iron oxide and cellulose acetate butyrate, essentially the same chemistry as rocket fuel. His theory was that it was the skin that caught fire first, not the hydrogen. This theory was dramatic and made for great TV, but most airship historians and engineers have pushed back on it. The doping compound was flammable, yes, but not explosively so, and the speed of the fire's propagation matches hydrogen combustion far better than fabric ignition. There was even a sabotage theory. The Hindenburg flew under the Nazi flag. She was a propaganda tool of the Third Reich, with swastikas on her tail fins, and not everyone in Germany was loyal to the regime. A rigger named Eric Spail, who died in the crash, was later suggested as a possible saboteur. He had access to the gas cells and had connections to people opposed to the Nazis, but there was never any hard evidence. Just circumstantial threads that unravel if you pull them too hard. What we do know is that the Hindenburg burned, and with her burned the entire concept of the rigid airship. The Zeppelin company had one more ship, the Graf Zeppelin II, LZ-130. She flew a few more times but never carried a paying passenger. By 1940, both she and the original Graf Zeppelin were scrapped. Their duralumin melted down for the German war machine. No rigid airship has flown in scheduled passenger service since.
And that's the part that gets me, because the Hindenburg disaster, as terrible as it was, had a survival rate of about 62%. 62 out of 97 people walked away. For a fire of that intensity at that altitude, that is extraordinary. In airplane crashes of similar magnitude in that era, the survival rate was often zero, but it didn't matter. The image was too powerful. The newsreel footage played in every movie theater in America, Morrison's recording played on every radio, the public saw a giant machine dissolve into fire in half a minute, and they were done. The age of the airship was over. What replaced it? Pan American Airways had already been eyeing transatlantic service with flying boats. The Boeing 314 Clipper entered service in 1939. Heavier than aircraft, took over the Atlantic routes, and they never gave them back. By the time the war ended, the Douglas DC-4 and the Lockheed Constellation were crossing oceans at 300 miles an hour, and nobody was talking about airships anymore. Sometimes I wonder what might have been. The Germans had wanted to fill the Hindenburg with helium, not hydrogen. Hugo Eckener, the old Zeppelin master, had designed the ship for helium from the start. But the United States controlled the world's helium supply through the Helium Control Act of 1927, and Washington would not sell helium to Nazi Germany, so the Zeppelin company was stuck with hydrogen. 7 million cubic feet of it. If they had gotten the helium, the Hindenburg would not have burned. She might have landed safely that evening, taken on passengers, and flown back to Frankfurt. The airship age might have continued at least for a while longer. That is one of the great what-ifs in all of aviation. But the fire happened, and it happened in front of cameras and microphones and a crowd of witnesses at the exact moment in history when mass media could carry the image to millions of people overnight. The Hindenburg did not just crash, she crashed on camera, and that made all the difference. 89 years ago today, May 6, 1937, Lakehurst, New Jersey, 37 seconds. I drew from Dan Grossman's exhaustive work at airships.net, Rick Archbold's book Hindenburg, An Illustrated History, and the original investigation records from both the U.S. Commerce Department and the German Board of Inquiry. If you want to see the field where it happened, Lakehurst is now part of Joint Base McGuire-Dix Lakehurst, and there's a small memorial on the exact spot. Worth the drive. More at radiohanger.com. See you next time.